for tuning in to another episode of the BC Association of School Psychologists podcast. We are so excited to bring you helpful ideas for your practice, supported by experts and research. Today, Kathleen and I are joined by Dr. Juliana Negreiros. She is a registered psychologist with extensive research and clinical experience conducting psychoeducational assessments and working with schools to develop school-based interventions. She's conducted studies at the BC Children's Hospital around pediatric OCD and brings a wealth of experience in many different areas. We're so excited to have her. Now, before we begin with our formal content, we'd first like to take this time to acknowledge the unceded territories where we are learning and unlearning and joining you from. I am joining you with deep gratitude and respect from the ancestral and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish Nation, and Tsleil-Waututh Nation.
And I am Kathleen Cherry, and I am joining you from the traditional territories of the Coast Salish, the Sooke, Chialnu, Nuchalnuth, and Pechida Nations, as well as the traditional territory of the Esquimalt and Songhees Nations.
And thank you so much for joining us today and furthering the conversation about child and youth mental health and how best to support our students within the school system. Many of our listeners are school psychologists. I am wondering if there's a key snippet of information or an idea that you would like listeners to make sure they take away from this discussion.
Hello, James and Kathleen. I'm so thankful to be part of this podcast today and to be sharing a little bit more about my passion of working with anxious students in the school system and also supporting school psychologists in their work, their real life work. So today, one of the main things I would like to bring up to our conversation is the importance of when we talk about school accommodations for kids who are anxious or have OCD, that the school accommodations should be temporary. And this is a really key concept that I think for many of us may not sit well because we think about, helping children be at school for extensive periods of time, which is the main goal. However, when we are talking about anxiety and OCD, we know that as symptoms improve, those school accommodations should be gradually removed because they tend to make their symptoms worse in the long run. And we can talk more about why this happens, but I guess that's kind of the main take-home message I would like to share today.
And actually, Juliana, we'd love for you to expand on that. What makes them helpful for it to be a temporary accommodation?
That's right. So we know that anxiety, most of the time, is a condition or we experience symptoms related to our need to get out of situations that are perceived as dangerous, when most of the time they aren't real threats, but rather they are perceived threats. And the only way that our brains learn that these threats are not real and they are manageable is by facing them gradually. So when we talk about anxiety and how to get better, one of the key ingredients of the treatment that is the gold standard treatment for anxiety called cognitive behavior therapy or CBT is that people have to be gradually exposed to the fear situation, see what happens, and learn that they can cope with it. If the situation happens or if it does not happen. And by learning that you can cope with it little by little, you increase your confidence and your fear about the situation or the uncomfortable feelings you have decrease over time to the point that you may not need those accommodations if we are talking about school accommodations due to different fears that kids experience at school. So that's kind of why they should be temporary, because our brains need to learn that we can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's how we get better.
That's awesome. And that's such an important pillar of CBT, as we talked about that exposure piece, having it be gradual to a dose that the client, that the child can take so that they don't feel immediately overwhelmed. And at the same time, are still learning that, hey, I can deal with this, right? I got this. Before we go any further, we'd love to know your background. What led you to the work that you do now and being able to impact the lives of so many?
Sure. So since I was a kid, I was always interested in why humans behave the way that they behave and what could we do to help them just reach their life goals and to be happy and have a meaningful and fulfilling life. So based on that, I pursue a degree in psychology. And at the same time, I was working at an international school as a teaching assistant with preschoolers. And I always loved the intervention with the mental health piece of getting kids adjusted to the school gradually, especially when they were 3 years old and the parents were dropping them off and we had to do everything that we had to do to keep them at school. And little by little, I learned that sometimes acting on our intuition is really helpful, but I wanted also to have some data to guide my decisions to support children. And that's how I came across school psychology as a graduate program. And I pursued the degree at UBC. So I did my master's and PhD at UBC. And while I was working towards my master's, I started working as a school psychologist for my internship. And I just loved working in the school system. And especially I found it that I loved the psychoed assessment piece, like the academics and cognitive, but I was mostly passionate about the mental health piece of the assessments. And that's why I decided to pursue a PhD where I could focus on more on the mental health. And then I came across anxiety and talking about evidence. That's how I felt very confident that the treatment worked for most people. And then I really wanted to incorporate the anxiety, the CBT model into the school system and help educators to support kids there. And that's how it came across. I was invited to be part of the EASE, the Everyday Anxiety Strategies for Educators development of the curriculum. So I was there from the beginning. And then later on, that led to another curriculum in schools to help teachers and school counselors, school psychologists to help children with anxiety. So I think that kind of like it was a combo of different things from being a kid curious about, you know, human beings to needing some evidence to support decisions, to loving mental health and seeing how kids with anxiety and OCD would get better with the right treatment, to incorporating this in schools and now presenting at BCAST and then in this podcast, that is very exciting. So it's kind of like a combining everything together for me. Yeah.
I love all of that. And I love the positive feeling that what you are saying and the strategies that we can help our students gain to cope with some of the harder times that they have. One of the things that I know I have been noticing in my school district is the school avoidance and attendance challenges. And I feel that it has become heightened since the pandemic. And I know you've touched somewhat on this already. I know that for myself, working with school teams, we often develop what we consider as very helpful programs within the school system, but the challenge is getting the student into the school, and it can feel quite frustrating. And I'm wondering if you have recommendations or strategies which school psychologists could advocate, which might help to grow that student engagement and attendance.
Yeah, I find that school refusal is one of the most difficult challenges to work with, especially in private practice. We know that school refusal or school avoidance, it starts most of the time gradually. It's not overnight. We also know that the symptoms begin usually after a long holiday or somebody being sick for a while. And we also know that there are stressful events that could be happening at home, between friends, with other peers, that can also cause the school avoidance. So I guess that my first step is to understand where is this coming from. why are they avoiding? Because depending on what they are avoiding, you may be able to manage their gradual entry, right? So there are some studies that show, and even there are rating scales that can help you assess that, that show that school avoidance can come in four shapes. One is because the person is avoiding something related to school, like a specific class. It could be a specific person. It could be a specific teacher. It could be a specific situation like tests. And then we also know that sometimes they're trying to escape some social situation. Sometimes they're trying to get attention from others, sometimes at home, if they stay home. And also they may get some positive reinforcement out of the staying at home. So I can play video game instead of having to, you know, really understand this concept of math. That's much nicer to play video games all day or sleep in. So we really need to understand where is this coming from, and not just judge by the cover, but you would have to talk to the student and find out more if they open up to you. And if they don't, perhaps getting a safe adult that the student connects with to talk a little bit more about this. So I think step number one, let's understand the function of the behavior. And then step number two is to develop this plan where gradually the student will be exposed to school. And it's very important to work with families as partners. Why is that? Home tends to be a reinforcement place for kids to be when they are not at school, meaning they have access to internet, they have access to games, they can sleep in, they can hang out with other friends outside of school. They can do all these kind of really positive things as well if they are not at school. So we really need to help families understand that home cannot be a reinforcing place, because then you cannot compete with that when you go to school, because the school is hard work. So that's kind of step number one. So if kids are staying home, there should be a routine for them. There should be chores. There should be homework. They shouldn't have access to internet or screens, and kind of like make home a boring place. So then they have to think twice before not going to school. That's kind of to start off. And some families have a very hard time setting boundaries, right? So I think it's our job to educate them and to work in partnership and to do our best for them to understand how we can do this together. Another strategy is that sometimes having a friend to pick them up to go to school can be helpful, right? So having someone that they trust, or sometimes even like an EA who has time, sometimes that happens, having someone else to come to school with you. And if school, the specific class, is a very triggering place, let's start small. It could be that they spend half of the day, you know, in the library, or if the library is too triggering, how about every day going for a walk around the school when there is no one around? So I would encourage the school and the families to work together in partnership to do a gradual exposure to school and to the main triggers that are contributing to this fear of the child being there. Being a school psychologist myself, I also sometimes I want to understand their cognitive and academic profile. Why is that? Because they may really want to do well, but they might have a learning disorder, or there is something else happening in the background that is making them not succeed and reach their goals. And that could also impact the school attendance because they just feel so bad about not doing well. So I think that there are lots of pieces of the puzzle to understand before putting a plan in place. But the bottom line is like, how can we support kids to be at school? And at times you do have to put all these school accommodations that I'm telling you to temporarily remove until the symptoms improve. Because anxiety and OCD symptoms come and go. Is not something like ADHD or autism that will be there, right? So you really need to have ongoing accommodations for it. With anxiety and OCD, it's quite the opposite, because the more accommodations, the better they feel in the short run, but the symptoms tend to get worse in the long run, because, for example, they will never learn how to present in class because they didn't have to do that. So then they want to go to university, but then there are some presentations that they need to have had the experience before to be able to do. So we really have to think long run with anxiety. And also make sure that students are receiving the mental health support they need to feel confident. And this is also coming from us. So I guess that bottom line, as educators, is really important to educate students and families about how anxiety works, the anxiety trap of the short-term relief when you escape, but the long-term pain when you don't face it. And then you go from there with the buy-in, with the rationale, and develop a plan in collaboration.
Juliana, you had so many great points there. One thing I just want to take a moment to circle back to is the idea of families as partners in all of this, right? You talked about how it's so important to make the home the kind of boring environment where, hey, maybe if I go to school, school's more interesting, right? Or even if I just go a little bit, at least there's a friend there who makes me feel nice. And so I'm more likely to go there. And I think I've come across so many families too, who they cognitively understand this idea of, okay, making school more stimulating rather than home is a great way to motivate them. But they're also like super busy, right? They have different jobs. They're not able to stay home and supervise their child. And so all the more, as you say, you know, that relationship with the parents is so important, because then you can be collaborative and try and brainstorm different ideas to make it work. And to get them to fully buy into it, right? Because that's the key. That's how you get them to make home boring.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Juliana, I also want to spend a little bit of time touching base on OCD, as we know you've got an interest in that. There seems to be a lot more cases of individuals, children, youth that teachers are talking about as having OCD-like symptoms. We'd love to get some more information, your thoughts on how to best support these students and also the families and teachers that work with them.
Oh, don't even know where to start, because I have so much to share about OCD. But I guess that my first question would be, what kind of behaviors are teachers observing? Are we talking about the classic OCD contamination? I need to go to the bathroom to wash my hands. I'm wearing barriers to touch things. Are we talking about more the repetitive behaviors of watching children tap and erase over and over again? Are we talking about the more subtle ones, which are related to reassurance, excessive reassurance? So asking if they are doing a good job, asking many excessive questions about the same topic over and over and over again. What kind of OCD tendencies are we talking about? Because there are so many. In the school system, the classic ones that teachers may notice are related to contamination, as I said, related to perfectionism. So students either spending too much time doing assignments or erasing and rereading and just getting really stuck and not working effectively. And those are the students that who often get A's, right? We really like 100%. So they work really hard for 100%, but they overwork and they start missing out on important things to do, like socializing, sleeping, eating properly, and many other things. So it would be really important for the teachers to notice what kind of behaviors they are observing and how is that getting in the way of learning. So I would say that that's step number one. And step number two would be to understand where is this coming from and to help them reduce. That's probably what the teachers are observing, are the compulsions or the repetitive behaviors. So how can we reduce that? So for example, if you notice that a student is over and over and over and over again asking the same question, you can set some limits around how many times they can ask a certain question. If you're noticing that the student is going to the bathroom frequently, you can set some limits around how many times they're going to go to the bathroom. So setting limits that are achievable, they are not too overwhelming, could be a start, but also coming from a caring place of trying to understand and support, and also to help them. I developed a handout for schools that is on the Anxiety Canada website, is on how educators can support students with OCD in schools, and it's like a four-pager, I think, with just some more general information about OCD and what to do in certain situations. So I would encourage, if you have a student that you are questioning if they have OCD and the behaviors are getting in the way, maybe take a look at the handout. And another resource I would suggest is I put all my favorite resources on OCD, anxiety, ADHD on my website for my clinic, which is beaconpsychology.ca. So if you want to learn more about OCD, if you want to watch videos, and I have specific recommendations for our schools, I would encourage you to check that out.
That's awesome. Thank you. And we can be sure to add those links to our show notes for our listeners.
Thank you. Very interesting. I feel like we have all these questions, and it's so lovely to bounce ideas with you. So one of the issues that we have been hearing a lot about is pathological demand avoidance, particularly in the ASD population. And I'm just wondering if you have any information, or that's something that you have noticed as well, ideas or suggestions.
I find that it's very interesting that you're bringing this topic up, because this is a hot topic in my field right now, with parents coming to me and say, I think my child has PDA, or educators consulting with me on it. And I'm no expert in autism, and even less in PDA. But of course, I started doing my research because I want to better understand how to support individuals who may have a PDA profile and all of that. So I have more questions than answers. So maybe I could just bring them up. One of the main things, like when I learn about a new approach, is I want to find the evidence and the research behind it. And one of the things I found so far, and I might be completely off, so please let me know if I'm not on the right direction here, is that most, if not all, of the research comes out of this specific group in the UK. I haven't seen research done by other organizations in different places of the world. And another question I have about that is that this is like a number of characteristics that seem to fit the profile of so many students we see, not just with autism. Right? It has an ODD flavor, but it seems to me that it comes from a different place. So it's not out of anger or oppositionality per se, but it's more coming from uncertainty, overwhelm, and an anxiety, and some anxiety. So that's kind of like how I conceptualize. My question, which I would love to have an answer, is that what can we do to help? Where is the evidence that this works? Because dropping all demands to me can be quite concerning, and I know it's not black and white. At the same time, I would like to know how to support these students who are really struggling, meeting expectations and following through demands and all of that. So I have more questions than answers, but I would love to see a protocol saying, hey, this is how you do it. I understand that some people do more of a collaborative approach where you're finding what really motivates the child, and then you get them, you pick your battles, and I just find that that's very hard work, especially I can imagine as a teacher with another 28 kids in your classroom. And how do you make this feasible? So I have more questions than answers. But I would like to highlight that I only found research coming from a specific group, and I would love to see more research coming from different groups, I guess.
Thank you. And I think we're also in the place where we have a lot of questions. I'm reaching out to various people to see if we can find an expert for the podcast. So stay tuned. We might be able to find some answers. But that's the wonderful thing about this field is the questions and trying to find the experts and the research and information on how best to help these individuals. So thank you for that.
Now, before we start to wrap things up, Juliana, I actually wanted to circle back to our first topic of discussion today about anxiety. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions, strategies for getting the kids to buy into doing the work of CBT. I can just imagine certain kids that I see being outright, if you ask them, hey, are you okay with being exposed to X, right? Or are you okay with having to do Y? And they'll flat out be like, no, they might even run out, et cetera. And this is why we see these kids, right? But at the same time, what are your thoughts on how to get them to buy in?
Excellent question. And I feel that if you don't get the buy-in, or at least the understanding why you're doing what you're doing, they're definitely not going to want to see you, right? So it's very important for us to talk to them about how is anxiety taking over their lives. What are the things that anxiety is taking away from them? Sometimes it's fun time at home because I'm just doing my homework all the time. Other times it's socializing. Other times it's playing, you know, with my siblings. It could be enjoying extracurricular activities. So you really have to map out what are the things that matter to them, and how is anxiety getting the way of those things. So the question I often ask is like, what matters to you? What do you really care about? And where are you at in terms of walking towards that, to reaching that goal, to being that person you want to be? And often what you hear is that, you know, maybe home life is great, but I have a really hard time going to school, and I really care about doing well, and I want to go to university. And so that's kind of how you link and say, okay, so anxiety is really getting in the way of you being this person you want to be and doing well at school. So would you be open to trying a different approach where, and then you explain what exposure is like and what it would be life like? And that's a big question. What would be life like if anxiety is not guiding your actions, right? Because I think a misconception is that they may think, oh, if treatment is successful, I will never feel anxious again about school. And that's not the point. The point is you can learn how to handle the anxiety and do things that matter to you, right? You can leave the anxiety in the background. We all have that anxiety voice sometimes. But that's not holding you back from doing important things. So I think it's important for them to understand that it's okay to have anxiety, to feel anxious, and do the things that matter. And that's where the gradual exposure comes. Because you expose them to a feared situation, they feel anxious in the moment, and they go and they give that presentation, right? And they go and they talk to that friend, and they go and they take that test. So rather than avoiding, because you really have to also explain how avoidance just makes this worse in the long run. If they have this understanding, little by little, they might be more open to trying things out, being successful, and then they build from the success. And they're like, okay, now I'm ready for the next one, and I'm ready for the next one. But they need to understand the rationale.
That makes sense. What do you think about using reinforcements incentives as the key term here being a temporary way to motivate action and participation?
Yeah, I think reinforcements are essential in this work. Some parents come to me and say, oh, I don't want to bribe my kid. And the answer I always give back to them is, you're not bribing, you are rewarding for hard work. This is not because they want to be doing this. They don't want to be struggling doing homework for 7 hours in a row because it doesn't feel perfect. It's really hard work to set a time limit and just work for 3 hours instead. And sometimes having this reinforcement at the end saying, I'm going to do all this hard work and here's my payoff. It doesn't have to be anything big. It could be, you know, extra time on screens, or it could be playing a game with a parent, or at school, it could be I'm allowed to have some downtime. Right. So you can play by ear with what kind of reinforcement you're going to use. And it doesn't have to be tangible all the time. It could be other things related to things that make them feel good, activities or time spent with a certain teacher or person. But that's really important to get them motivated to do the hard work. So I would refrain from bribing, because this is not bribing. This is, helping them get through something really hard.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for clarifying that, Juliana. And so we'd love to give you this opportunity as well, just to talk about any kind of projects you've got coming or things that you're working about that we can look forward to.
Sure. One of the main things I like doing in my career is to collaborate and consult, especially with schools. I love working with parents as well, but schools is where my heart is, and I'm not working right now in the specific school district. So I provide consultation to schools and workshops, and that's where my heart is. And the second thing that I'm planning and is being confirmed and very excited to share is that I'm going to be presenting at BCASP again this year, on a different topic, which is going to be OCD in schools. So if you enjoyed the dance party and my previous talk, wait for this new talk I'm giving. It's not going to be a dance party, but it's going to be very experiential. And I hope some of you attend and enjoy it.
That sounds wonderful. I certainly hope to be there.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you so much again. Juliana, we appreciate you. We appreciate that you've taken the time to share your expertise and join us in this episode.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great start of the week for me, talking to you both and spreading some of my knowledge to my dear colleagues. So thank you very much.
It's been so lovely. To our listeners, stay tuned for our next episodes and do connect with us on our socials. We have Instagram, Twitter, or now known as X, and also Facebook, BC Association of School Psychology. Links will be in the show notes. Thank you very much.